ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we have another conversation with Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell and author of the book Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger. That's coming up a little later, but first some news.
From the online newsletter, The Dodo, our personalities are at the foundation of who we are. But as unique as we might feel in that mix of positive and negative qualities which makes us individuals, the complex structure of traits that comprise our personalities is not possessed by humans alone. As it turns out, our closest primate cousins share a nearly identical set of personality traits as we do, and they're structured in the same way too. Primatologists have long used a test called the Chimpanzee Personality Questionnaire to assess chimps' temperament, answering questions in different categories about the animal's observed behavior. A research team made up of psychologists, neuroscientists, and primatologists closely analyzed the results from 174 chimpanzees and found a familiar pattern. Chimps could be divided into two basic types: alpha, who are more dominant and aggressive, or beta, more social and inclined to play. Much like in humans, five distinct personality factors could be identified in the chimps, traits that blend to form an individual: conscientiousness, agreeability, dominance, intellect, and extroversion. Interestingly, neuroscientists were able to correlate chimps' personality types to their genetics. Chimps with a gene that triggered production of the neuropeptide called vasopressin fell into the dominant category, suggesting an evolution plays a hand in the formation of our personalities. It should come as no surprise to find similarities in the most fundamental aspect of what makes chimps and humans who they are, especially since, in terms of our DNA, we're more alike than not.
Planet Ark reports Los Angeles has banned the use of bullhooks, pitchforks, baseball bats, and other goads that circus trainers use to control elephants and other exotic animals, delighting campaigners and angering showmen. Animal rights groups such as PETA and celebrities, including actress Kristen Bell, comedian Sarah Silverman, and singer Keisha, have campaigned against the use of the prods that they say amount to torture. The ban takes place effective in January 2017, a delay meant to give circuses time to change how they handle elephants or to remove them from the show, which draws audiences of over 100,000 people. Stephen Payne, spokesman for circus operator Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey, said the law was completely unnecessary and would force the cancellation of Los Angeles circus events, although City News Services quoted him as saying that the circus may move to a venue outside the city limits. Council members said that zoos, including the main one in Los Angeles, have stopped using the spike-tipped bullhooks amid sweeping evidence that they cause physical and psychological harm to elephants and other exotic animals. Using bullhooks is inhumane and unhealthy, according to City Councilor Paul Koretz, who said that he voted in favor of the ban after a video was shown to the council that highlighted elephant training tactics and exercises he said were cruel. The circus is welcome in Los Angeles, just without the bullhooks, according to Koretz. He's hoping that they will follow the model of other circuses that don't use exotic animals.
According to a recent report by Friends of the Earth Europe, the current industrialized meat and dairy production system is untenable and needs a radical rethink to reduce its impact on the environment. The report says that the current system depends on scarce land and water resources. Meat and dairy production is having an increasingly devastating impact on society and the environment. According to the report, intensive meat production isn't only torture for the animals, it destroys the environment and devours great chunks of our raw materials, which we import from the global south as animal feed. After China, Europe is the biggest importer of soybeans. Argentina and Brazil are dramatically increasing their soy cultivation, and it's being fed almost exclusively to the animals we slaughter. rising meat consumption is forcing up land prices. According to the report, this has devastating consequences, with almost a third of the world's land being used to grow animal feed. It also says that small farmers are losing their land and their livelihoods, and the food security of many people in the global south is in jeopardy. Outlining the impact of intensive meat and dairy production on fresh water usage and land, the report finds that worldwide agriculture consumes 70% of available fresh water, one-third of which goes towards raising livestock. The increasingly intensive livestock sector is also one of the largest consumers of land and edible crops, with more than half of the annual output of wheat, rye, oats, and corn used for animal feed, and one-third of the world's cultivated land used to grow it. The growing global demand for meat is a serious concern. The growing economies, such as Asia, will see around an 80% increase in the demand for meat and dairy products by the end of the decade. Stick around. Coming up next, we feature another conversation with Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell and author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us once again on the program is Sherry Kolb. Last time, Sherry, we talked about some of the questions in your book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger? And we talked about a number of the questions, such as, what about plants? Don't they have feelings too? And we discussed that, and we talked about the pleasure people find in eating and how many people fear that a plant-based diet might deprive them of something that gives them pleasure.
Well, I think we also talked about animal welfare reform.
Right,
and,
right.
And why I'm reluctant to support them, even though I understand the impulse behind them.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't necessarily spend my time fighting for any kind of welfare reform issues. I'd much rather try to get people to go vegan, but that's a very hard thing to do. What is your approach? What do you think is the best method to introduce somebody to the concept of veganism?
Well, for me, because I teach a course, what's nice is that people sign up for the course, and then they have essentially by doing so asked, so why would anybody do this? And so I get to assign readings, and I can't really do that with people on the street. Well, here's a reading list. Let's talk about it. So that's one context where I can really sort of present people with the weakness of the case against it, because to some degree it's easy to think of the default position as what most people are doing and say, well, the default position is violence against animals and consumption of animal products. And you know, my feeling is, well, let's look at why that's the current default, and there isn't really any of the arguments that people make on behalf of it are really quite weak and often premised on false information. And there's so many great things about being vegan, even apart from the fact that you're sparing these animals. So when people who are not in my class, you know, the way I advocate is frequently that, you know, people will notice that I'm vegan, and then they might ask a question about why. Is it for ethical or is it for health reasons? And then, you know, and then they might ask questions, they might ask me for a recipe, or I might have a potluck. And it's nice with potlucks because people then want to prepare vegan food, and they feel like, oh, it's a challenge, and they do it, and if it's really good, they're excited about it. And so just sort of looking at the positive side of it rather than what it's not, because I don't think of it as, oh, I'm a vegan, so I'm someone who doesn't do the following things. I think of somebody who pursues this amazingly rich, abundant life that, you know, that's at peace with the other beings on this planet.
You know, one of the questions that I get a lot, and I was really excited to see in your book, and which is quite funny, I think, is you know, wouldn't farmed animals disappear if we stopped eating meat?
Yes, yeah, that's a very common one.
And that's usually right after they, you know, are done belittling the value of an animal's life, and then all of a sudden they're empathetic with the idea that, yeah, farmed animals are important. You know, what do you say to that?
And there's a corollary to this, too. You often hear, well, if we stop eating the cows, they'll take over the earth.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's the other alternative.
Yeah, that's a real concern, the cow takeover. Yeah, well, when people say, well, isn't it better that they not go extinct? Isn't it like a genocide to stop consuming animal products? I mean, to some degree, I kind of wonder, as you've suggested, whether they actually are frightened of this possibility or whether this is just something people say. Like, I've never seen somebody who thinks that plants are sentient to resign themselves to not eating, for example, so that there's a certain potential, like, you know, defensiveness rather than making it a serious question. But I think that to the extent that it is a serious question, I like to point out that animals and DNA are two different things, or two different entities, and that extinction is a harm for DNA because DNA wants to replicate to the extent that we can attribute a desire to it. But an individual animal wants to live, wants to feel comfort, and that's what we take away when we, you know, when we consume them. What we take away if we don't keep breeding them is we take away, the, you know, their DNA's future exemplars. And I don't think of that as something that, you know, harmful we're doing to them. In fact, a lot of them have really evolved to be, you know, to suffer. Because we have essentially created a kind of survival of the least fit situation for the animals we farm by making them grow, by breeding selectively for those who grow really quickly, in the case of the animals whose meat we consume, and for the animals who produce eggs, we breed them so that they kind of lose most of the calcium in their bodies and in their bones. To eggs, they produce, you know, something like 300 eggs a year, the laying hens, which is compared, I mean, if we think of eggs as food, that might sound normal, but if we think of them as eggs are just how people, you know, how people and animals reproduce, that normally a chicken wouldn't have 300 children a year.
Right.
And so what we're doing is we're really kind of altering and distorting the reproductive process to create foods at the expense of the animals. And so I would actually, if we're talking about what animals should exist in the future, I would want there to be animals whose bodies don't give them terrible pain and distress and in order to make them a more suitable meal for us, which is really how evolution has moved for the animals we farm. The turkeys can't even mate naturally.
I was about to mention that. You know, I always think of turkey sex when the topic comes up. What I mean is, no, we have bred animals to the point where they're so unnatural, it would probably be a kindness to see them go extinct and to have the wild ancestors exist.
Exactly. And that's what, I mean, that's what would happen, is that their niche could be filled with animals who are currently actually being actively exterminated in order to protect, which I would put in quotes, the cattle of ranchers. We have wildlife management, which consists of essentially killing animals who might compete with us for the flesh of these unnaturally bred animals.
I'm a National Park Service ranger, and one of my main concerns is that the National Park Service is slaughtering the bison of Yellowstone to protect an alien species, the cows that graze in the area.
Yeah.
And so what do you say also to folks who say that, well, don't animals eat other animals, so why shouldn't we?
Yeah, that I get that one a lot. In one of my chapters, I had dinner with a woman who said, well, so you think lions are immoral? And no, I don't think lions are immoral, and that actually when we say animals eat other animals, I mean, some animals do, many animals don't, and actually it would be inefficient for the planet if most animals ate other animals, because then, we'd have a sort of pyramid in reverse. So many animals don't, and it happens that a lot of the animals we consume don't eat other animals. They certainly don't eat us. And, you know, and people say, oh, well, that cow would eat me if she could. And it's like, no, actually, there's no evidence of that. The cow doesn't want to eat you, just wants you to leave her alone. And
we're back to cows taking over the world.
Yeah. Right, exactly. After they eat us, the zombie cows take over the planet. So I think that there's that problem, is that while some animals eat other animals, many don't, and none of them are currently really threatening us, except, you know, I mean, there are insects who threaten our lives, but not the animals that we consume typically. So there's that. And it's also true that, you know, we have the capacity for deciding not to eat animals, and that's a capacity that not all animals who currently consume other animals have. And so, you know, we have a sort of a moral obligation that being a moral agent gives us that not all animals would have. So I don't think that a lion really has a choice as a matter of the sort of abstract moral reasoning that we're capable of doing.
But isn't it sort of specious to say that animals don't have morality? Because some animals exhibit altruism, and they can show mercy, and they can cheat and steal.
Yeah.
So aren't they moral agents?
Well, they might be. I wouldn't rule it out. And certainly some animals seem to act in ways that suggest an emergent morality. When you see that rats share with each other, they share chocolate, which is not something I typically see in humans. I agree with you, and I think it would be speciesist for us to rule out the possibility of it. But I think that when we're trying to figure out whether to hold another animal accountable for something, and whether that animal is human or not, we need to err on the side of not holding them accountable unless we really know that they're morally able to be held accountable. So that, you know, we see emergent morality in 3- and 4-year-old children, but we wouldn't put them in prison if they did something that, you know, something what we would call immoral if an adult did it. And in the same way, I think that, you know, we see emergent morality in other animals, and that I think that, you know, gives us a reason to, you know, respect their choices, but it doesn't give us a reason to, you know, to do harm to them. So I think that when you're looking for a reason to do harm, that you need to be pretty sure. Whereas if you're looking for a reason to not do harm, then you should err on the side of giving the benefit of the doubt to the animal. And that's why if we're not sure about a particular animal's sentience, but we have some reason to think the animal is, we ought to err on the side of presuming that the animal is and not consuming them.
And we shouldn't take our ethics on the behavior of animals either.
Yes, that's true. And we don't, you know, that it's odd that somebody who thinks we should consume animals would then take animal behavior as a role model that we should follow. And animals do all sorts of things that we might not do. So, you know, things that come naturally, I think, to us or to other animals, we can still make a decision not to do those things. You know, there are a lot of human violence might come naturally, and yet we refrain from doing those things.
Exactly. And that's another thing, like with morality, it had to come from somewhere. I mean, morality is probably a trait that evolved just like all the other traits we have. And so it's likely that there are the roots of morality in a lot of other animal species. And like you said, they're just not as well developed as they are in us, as far as we know, but they could be.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't rule it out at all. I mean, you'd see how dogs run into buildings to save people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I wouldn't want to, you know, blame a dog for for killing a rat or something like that. You know, and feel like that I can't explain to my dog why he really should stop chasing the bunnies in my yard.
You know, at one time, animals were put on trial.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes,
strange.
Very strange and very horrifying. And this sometimes happens. It doesn't really happen in the terms of a trial, but occasionally you see a case where an animal kept in a zoo, like a polar bear, will kill a child who climbs into the cage, and then they kill the polar bear. And it seems like that doesn't make a lot of sense because it looks like a punishment. The polar bear is just doing what a polar bear would naturally do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, and I remember people saying, well, why isn't Tillicum, you know, punished for murder if from SeaWorld?
Yeah.
And I feel like let's first not use him as a resource before we start endowing him with moral responsibility.
Sheesh.
Well, and along the lines of morality, I mean, what do you say to folks who say that God values us, you know, more than the other animals, and so we have a right to do as we please.
And what do you think of the film Noah?
Well, first of all, about Noah, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very excited that, as I understand, the director's vegan and didn't use animals in the film, just used the CGI for that. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
I was very excited. And for that reason alone, I hope to see it. And as I understand it, also the message there is really that that people have run into serious problems with the planet and with our own survival because of the consumption of animals. So I'm amazed and delighted that that message is out there in a mainstream film. As far as people saying that God prefers us to animals, my sense is that, you know, that may or may not be true, but that a lot of the biblical texts that people cite in support of the notion of our using animals turn out not to be as supportive as people think. So the part of the Bible where it talks about dominion, and which is now apparently people are starting to understand the word they're used to mean stewardship rather than dominion. Right. So I think that's an interesting development because that's a very different connotation. But in that same paragraph in Genesis, you have God telling people to eat a plant-based diet. And it says that you can have seeds and fruit and so on will be your food. Which has also long been translated to mean meat, but the Hebrew word actually means food, not meat. So that started to be retranslated as well. And so if you have in the same section of the Bible a directive to have stewardship or dominion over animals and also not to eat them, I think the message is that you can be powerful over someone and that does not entitle you to use that someone as a resource. So I think that in a way the very part of the Bible that people most invoke actually has a contrary message to it. And I think a lot of religions generally, and not just you know Judaism and Christianity, but religions generally have in them a kind of gesture towards compassion to animals, and that, you know, just as if we look at older religious texts, we're going to see indications of human prejudice, right? And we're going to have, for example, slavery in the Bible, that we can understand that to reflect human error to the extent if one believes in the divine, that's human error because nobody right now is really supporting slavery of humans as a directive from God. And so in the same way we can understand where you know, God says in the Bible to let the slaves rest on the Sabbath, that is a way of our understanding that we need to be compassionate and humane to our fellow beings and that we shouldn't have slaves at all. And in the same way, I think we can draw a similar conclusion about animals where it says, oh, you shouldn't take the baby birds while the mother is still there, or you shouldn't slaughter an animal in the first sacrifice, the first few days of life, that really we need to take that a step further. We shouldn't be slaughtering them at all. We shouldn't be taking babies from their mothers at all.
And we shouldn't be boiling babies in their own mother's milk.
Right.
You know, I've always believed that the most important thing in the Bible is do unto others as you would have them do to you, and that all the rest of it's just commentary.
Well, I would even argue if you say that God does value humans more than non-human animals, I think that still supports the stance that you shouldn't eat animals, because if we want to ensure that our species survives, you know, we have to take into consideration climate change and, you know, the large effect that is had on it by a meat-based diet.
That's absolutely right. I think that what we're doing to the planet by consuming animal products and what we're doing to our own health is really, you know, contravenes. It's sort of like smoking. You know, cigarettes don't have rights, but that doesn't mean we ought to smoke them. But, you know, I think along any dimension, in a way, that all roads lead to veganism in that sense, that you have concern about humans, concern about the planet, concern about animals would lead to this conclusion. And if God favors humans, I think part of that favoring is that humans have all this power, and that part of every religious teaching is that when you have power, you know, it's a Spider-Man saying, with great power comes responsibility, right?
Yeah.
And that's crucial, and that we've gotten the power part of the equation, but without the responsibility.
A lot of people, folks that believe in climate change and feel like we're at a path now where we can't turn back, they throw up their hands and say, you know, why should I bother being vegan? You know, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that that's overly pessimistic view, that actually if people, I mean, a lot of the measures that are taken, like, you know, oh, you should recycle or, you know, drive a Prius or whatever, that these are actually really tiny moves in comparison to giving up animal products. And that, you know, each person who gives up, and that's one of the things about the power of veganism, is that if just one person decides to become vegan, that has such a tremendous impact in terms of the use of water and the use of land and you know, pollution of our waterways and our air and global climate change, that, you know, it wouldn't even take everybody immediately becoming vegan, that we could really change the direction. And And that, you know, sort of throwing up our hands and saying, well, everything's screwed, so we might as well just do whatever we want. But that's such an unfortunate way to take things, because things can always be better or worse, and let's select the path to better.
Exactly.
I'm pessimistic. You sound more like an optimist to me, but I believe that things are screwed. But I'm not going to give up veganism. I see veganism as I won't take part in the destruction of the world.
Yeah. Well, that's another good reason to do it. Like, even if everyone's doing something bad, it's very worthwhile not to participate in that.
We've been talking with Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell and author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger? Sherry, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really fun.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Happy Mother's Day, Mom.